So I've got that to look forward to. Happy Mother's Day to me. Okay. We're going to camp out in Jonah 4:1 for a little bit today. We'll work through Jonah's accusation in response to God. Just a reminder of where we are historically and the stakes that are present in the story. Remember, the Assyrian Empire is starting to crumble from within and from without. They're being challenged by the Urartu Empire. They have all these famines. They have these uprisings. They're having all these problems. And it looks like at the time they were advancing towards Israel, because remember, if you want to be the biggest empire on the block, you have to go to war with Egypt. And in order for the Fertile Crescent to get to Egypt, you have to go through Israel. But all of these problems had caused the Assyrian Empire to stop attacking the northernmost outposts of Israel. And so it looked like God was finally enacting justice on people who needed justice enacted on them. And one of the things that I will not let us forget, the Assyrians are terrible people. Terrible people. And that plays into what Jonah is doing in chapter 4. Now, Jonah seems to think, when God says, hey, I need you to go to Nineveh and I need you to preach this message of repentance, Jonah runs away. And we've been through this a few times. He's not running because he's scared. He's not running because he doesn't understand. He's running because he thinks God is in the wrong. And that's a totally different ball game when you look at God and you say, you are in the wrong. Jonah's reading the tea leaves. He knows Assyria is coming. He also knows that if he doesn't go to Nineveh and the Ninevites don't get forgiven, that Assyria is going to crumble and Jonah might wind up, I'll say it, saving God's people rather than God saving the nation that's going to annihilate his people. Now, we know the story. We just read chapter 3. Nineveh's forgiven. Within 20 years of Jonah leaving, Sennacherib is going to make Nineveh the capital of the Assyrian Empire. And they will come in and annihilate Israel. Right? Only two tribes wind up surviving. And again, that's why we call them Jews. The kingdom of Judah is all that's left after Assyria rolls through and does their thing. So God forgives the Ninevites. Remember, I didn't put up the word shuv. Did I go over the word shuv last week? No? Okay. The word shuv is an interesting one in Hebrew. It means to repent or relent. The word actually means to kind of turn around and reverse course. And so Jonah is preaching a message of shuving from the Gadol Ra'ah to Nineveh. In other words, hey, you've committed great evil. You need to turn from it. The king of Nineveh in chapter 3 says, if we shuv from our Gadol Ra'ah, perhaps God will also shuv from his Gadol Ra'ah that he has planned for us. In other words, God is going to enact justice with a commensurate amount of evil, because remember, this word can mean both evil and disaster, calamity. And so if Nineveh shuvs of the Gadol Ra'ah, perhaps God will shuv for the Gadol Ra'ah. And that's exactly what seems to happen at the end of chapter 3. And boy, does it piss Jonah off. That's where we pick up in chapter 4. My translation says this, and I love the NET, but I wish they went a little more literal here. This displeased Jonah terribly, and he became very angry. Who's got a different translation? What do you got? You're in the NET too? Fair enough.
I got greatly displeased.
Greatly displeased?
Seemed very wrong.
Seemed very wrong? Yeah. I love how this reads in Hebrew. It was Ra'ah to Jonah. It was Gadol Ra'ah. God forgiving the Ninevites, that is what is evil in Jonah's mind. Look, Jonah already views the Assyrian Empire as evil, as Ra'ah. And the fact that a God of justice would forgive a people like that, a people who are knocking on the doorstep of Israel, that's what's Gadol Ra'ah to Jonah. And then the text says something fascinating. It says it burned him. It's a fascinating phrase. And the majority of civilizations are going to do something similar to this. They're going to associate warm temperatures with anger. And we do this in English too, right? We tell people, hey, you need to go cool down. Yes? And So you have this idea of burning in the face. When you get really angry, what happens to your face? It gets red, your face actually elevates in temperature. And so I want you to picture Jonah here. This is not just Jonah having a casual theological conversation with God saying, what are you doing? He's so mad, his face is red because he thinks, he is convinced that what God has done constitutes evil. And whoever wrote this book makes a fascinating linguistic connection, and we have to go here. The other time that this phrase is used in this way is in Exodus chapter 31 at the golden calf. So let's flip there real quick. I'm sorry, Exodus 32. So the people saw that Moses delayed in coming down from the mountain, and they gathered around Aaron and said, get up, make us a god that will go before us. And as for this fellow Moses, he who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what was become of him. And so Aaron said, break off the gold earrings that are on the ears of your wives, your sons, your daughters, bring them to me. And so all the people broke off their earrings that were on their ears. They brought them to Aaron. He accepted the gold, fashioned it with an engraving tool, made a molten calf, and then said, this is your God, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. And Aaron saw all of this, and he built an altar before the calf. And Aaron made a proclamation to the people and said, tomorrow will be a feast to the Lord. So they got up early. They offered up burnt offerings, brought peace offerings. The people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And then the Lord said to Moses, go quickly, descend, because your people whom you brought up, I love the not my problem, not my circus, not my monkeys anymore, right? Your people whom you brought up from the land of Egypt have acted corruptly. They quickly turned aside from the way I commanded them. They made for themselves a molten calf. They've bowed down to it, sacrificed to it, and said, this is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. And the Lord said to Moses, I've seen these people. They are stiff-necked. And then verse 10 is our target verse. Leave me alone so that my anger can burn against them and I can destroy them. So I want to pause here and ask for a second, why does God get so angry at this? Right? Israel is going to do a lot of really stupid stuff. A lot of really stupid stuff. But there's a small collection of times where God says something like, I'm going to destroy them. By the way, this word destroy, the word for annihilate is the exact same word used in chapter 3 to describe what's going to happen in Nineveh. When you see, yeah.
Well, isn't it because they just committed to the covenant, right? They just said, oh yeah, this is what we're going to do, God.
Right, and then Moses goes up to the top of the mountain, he's getting sunburned, he's writing some stuff down with the help of God, he's learning all these things, and they're like, huh, we saw all these plagues, we saw the sea part, we saw Pharaoh's army drowned, we saw all these amazing like provisions in the wilderness. Not for us, not good enough, right? If you look at your text carefully, what do they call the cow? It's not just a God that led them out of Egypt. Does everybody have Aaron saying, this is a proclamation to the Lord and it's in all capitals? Okay, somebody help me. What does that mean is in the Hebrew behind it? Anybody know? Yahweh. They call the cow Yahweh. Right, this is kind of key for our understanding of what's happening with the golden calf. This is not Israel creating a new God. This is Israel quite literally and figuratively boiling God down into what they want him to be. Not letting him be who he is. Right?
Glad we never do that.
Well, let's get uncomfortable when we go back to Jonah and talk about how we're the same. But look, that's what makes God so mad, it burns him. When you try to fit God into the box that you'd prefer him to fit in, that's what makes him so mad, it burns him. Flip that in Jonah 4:1. When God is who he is, that's what burns Jonah. And we have a fascinating dichotomy at play within the person of God. How can a God of justice forgive an unjust people like the Assyrians? How can a God who supposedly stands for righteousness, who supposedly stands for the good, look at a people that evil and say, you know what? You get forgiven too. And this is exactly what Jonah accuses him of. Verse 2, chapter 4. He prayed to the Lord and said, oh, Lord, this is exactly what I thought would happen when I was in my own country. This is what I tried to prevent by attempting to escape to Tarshish. I knew you would cave. I knew you would forgive him. And that's why I ran. And again, Jonah doesn't run because he's scared. Jonah runs because he disagrees. That's a big difference. I know that you are gracious and you are compassionate and you are slow to anger and you are abounding in mercy and you are one who shoves concerning judgment. So kill me because I would rather die than live. And I'm just going to fill in the blank that the text doesn't give us, but it's very clear. I would rather die than live in a world where the God of Israel has forgiven the Assyrian Empire. That's what he means. I would rather die. We see that in chapter 1. Throw me overboard. I'd rather be dead, because if I'm dead, the message of repentance dies with me. Or at least that seems to be what's going through Jonah's mind. I would rather die because it means that I don't have to live in a world where the most evil, the most heinous, the most vicious, the most violent empire that has ever existed up to this point. I don't have to live in a world where the God of love and mercy and righteousness has forgiven them. I would rather be dead then see you forgive an empire that is going to wipe out your chosen people. And that seems to be Jonah's problem. Jonah's problem is not even with the idea of forgiveness. It's with the idea of forgiveness for this specific people at this specific time. And I love how Jonah lists out these attributes of God, right? It's like a Sunday school lesson for three-year-olds where they're like, God is loving and compassionate and kind and gracious, and this is awesome. And Jonah says, it's awesome until those attributes of God come into direct conflict with the justice and righteousness of God. This is exactly what C.S. Lewis said when we read Mere Christianity last summer. Forgiveness is easy to talk about until you actually have something to forgive. And he brings up another evil empire that he was dealing with at the time, in the Nazis. Yeah.
He's even making that connection back to Exodus with his attributes of God.
He is.
It's
wild. Whoever wrote this book, and I'll go over this next week, it seems to have been written during the Babylonian exile. apparently, the tribes of Judah needed to be reminded of, you know, God forgiving their enemies, but we'll get there. But yes, whoever wrote this book has a very clear desire to point you back to what's going on in the Exodus. Yeah. Sure.
Is judging. And a lot of people I've talked to, and maybe they'll have too, they said, if God is like that and he will forgive a murderer, and I'm so good, basically,
right,
I would rather go to hell, basically.
It is a fascinating, they're fascinating attributes that somehow God holds intention. Is he righteous? Yes. Is he compassionate? Yes. Does he execute judgment? Yes. Does he extend grace? Yes. And it is easy for me to pontificate about forgiveness because I'm not under threat of annihilation. Right? This is a totally different ballgame for Jonah. Different ballgame for Israel. Quite honestly, a different ballgame for God. And even though God is these things constantly, the tension within the person of God, within those attributes of how on earth is it merciful or just or righteous or good or compassionate to forgive Assyria but not forgive Israel and allow them to be annihilated in 722. How does that work? Now, here's what I want to say. And I've taught this book for a long time. And every time I get here, these words are going to come out of my mouth and they taste bitter. But I think it's true. I think Jonah has a point. I'm just going to say it. I think Jonah's got a point. I'm not saying he's right. I'm not saying at the end of the day that he's right and God's wrong. Hear me clearly. I'm not saying. Yeah. But I get where he's coming from. Does that make sense? Yeah. God is then going to orchestrate a series of object lessons for Jonah, right? Jonah's going to throw his temper tantrum. God's going to say, all right, I'll treat you like a toddler and I'll give you all these object lessons. And we'll go into that next week. But this is nooks and crannies. Paul gives me permission every week to make you uncomfortable, to make me uncomfortable. There are certain attributes of God that I wish he did not have. There are times in my life where, depending on where I am and what I'm experiencing, that I wish God was my version of a golden calf, that I could boil him down into what I want him to be, that he would do what I want him to do and not be who he is, but rather be my projection of who I want him to be. There are times when I am not comfortable with the goodness of God, with the forgiveness of God. I want it for myself, but there are times I don't want it for other people. Right? There are times where I wish that God was more like me instead of me being more like him. That seems to be what Jonah's going through. Right? Now, Jonah takes it a step farther than me. I've never actually gotten so mad the blood boils in my face and I'm telling God it's pure evil that you forgive evil. But I get it. Especially considering the stakes at play here. This is not just a theological conversation in the abstract. This particular conversation, this particular extension of grace, of forgiveness, has catastrophic consequences that will change the trajectory of God's chosen people. And that's what this story wants us to ask. Am I okay with the fact that God forgives an evil empire to annihilate the people that are supposedly his? Am I okay with that? How do I deal with that? How do I wrestle with that? If you've read this book before, you know it ends on a cliffhanger. There's no ending to this book. Like, it's an atrocious ending. It just kind of finishes. We'll get there next week. It's supposed to leave you confused, a little bit frustrated, a little bit like, man, this Jonah guy might have a little bit of a point. At least I understand where he's coming from, and what does that say about me? So here's where I'm going to turn you loose today for a little bit of group discussion. Which attribute of God frustrates you the most? It is. And I want you to think about this, because here's the other delightful thing about God. I've got a few minutes, I can say this. God is the only being who knows my heart better than I know it. Yes? And he's one of the only people I lie to constantly. He knows when I'm pissed off at him. He knows when I'm frustrated with him. He knows when I disagree with him. He knows these things. And yet, I like have this weird theological conundrum where I'm supposed to say the right words and do the right thing. You know, kind of like Jonah in the belly of the fish in chapter 2. It's not like God doesn't know I'm frustrated with a part of who he is. And it's not like God isn't capable of handling my anger or my frustration. And I think part of being in an honest relationship with God is being willing to admit when something about him makes us mad, when I'd rather have the golden calf Because at least with the golden calf, I get to pick and choose his attributes. At least with the golden calf, I get to pick and choose who gets forgiven and who gets justice. So there's my question. Which attribute of God frustrates you the most? Go.